As I said, that the greatest possibility in life is to be, to have the Dhamma in mind upon the transition as the body dies. And so the clarification that the body is what dies and that what is cultivated in this life continues as life, as manifesting form, power. And putting, you know, the Dhamma in perspective in a way that is can be support and maintained and throughout what might one might call the latter stage of life. And I termed it personally disintegration because I find it's a very poignant word. And if you notice that the little Japanese crest is cherry blossoms with a skull. And in the Theravadin tradition, there's an Asuma practice, which at some level we might be engaging in, where we're watching the disintegration. My body has begun to be arthritic. I love my arthritis. I'm sorry I can't join the speed at which the world is going. You know, it is my pleasure to continue to choose to go slowly and to know what there is to know, as I have learned in my youth in practice, is so valuable. So, you know, it's like over 40 years of Dhamma now just settles in very nicely into this process of change as we break down or as our bodies break down. And as we recognize what's possible, that it is not the Dhamma that is dying, but are disintegrating or such, it's the body. And we've been using quite a bit of our efforts during my mini residency to actually enter into the awareness with the body so that one can really work from this foundational consciousness that opens through embodiment, as is emphasized in the Satipatthana Sutta. That it's here that the consciousness exists that can then open to include the mind door as well, and to recognize the skillful use of mind, fullness, sati. So that's that. I just thought I would say that since people had mentioned and I had heard, you know, that there was some curiosity about that. And so the two events this year that are associated with this these beginnings are at BCBS. This will be my second or third year, And then also this retreat that has been organized that I've been invited to teach that's taking place, interestingly enough, where I live in Ashland, Oregon. As far as these events are concerned in registration, I have no idea. But the one in Ashland is limited to just 20 people, since it's the first one. And it's intended to be a gathering point for investigation, for practice and investigation. And therefore, in that sense, like I was saying concerning Sangha yesterday, you know, we sit together, we inquire together, and therefore we have a sense of communion and a rarefied community. So this is what this is about, and I believe there are just a couple of spaces left in the Oregon retreat, but it will occur again. Yes.
Could you say, for those that don't know, what BCBS is?
Oh, I'm sorry, the Barry Center, do you know the Insight Meditation Society out in Barry, Massachusetts? Yeah, it's a complex retreat center, study center, and long-term retreat center. So this will be at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, and then other things that are kind of intersecting there that have more to do with that community that aren't public that I'll be doing when I'm out there. But the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies is a superb aspect of that particular organization. because it brings clarifications to that juncture of you know, the experiential and the intellectual. Very, very, that's what they're dedicated to. And does preserve, therefore, and help to preserve clarity and clarification associated with, you know, the teachings and practice. Joseph regularly teaches there and other people that you may be aware of, Joseph Goldstein. The other thing that I wanted to as well bring into the fold, and this isn't specific to me, but I enjoyed, was it Victoria? Reflections on Donna, and I wanted to clarify that since it feels like maybe there are a number of people that have sort of just entered into this meditation culture as is held here in Albuquerque and also into the practice, and you know, that there's a language that might be new to you. And today, if there's anything that I say that you do not understand, rather, this is the, you know, one of the benefits of our being together, is that which is opening to inquiry, a term, an experience, you know, whatever, is what we can reflect on today, and we all benefit by doing this together as a Sangha. And that term Donna, which is such a mysterious term in our culture and actually is flailing. There are people who are very attuned to the Dhamma and this era of Dhamma who feel that Dhamma is flailing because of the fact that it's kind of been gobbled up into this, you know, into the world through the term mindfulness. Mindfulness this, mindfulness that, mindfulness this, as a kind of commodity. And there's wonderful dialogue about this that's happening and recognition, and therefore Joseph's book, Joseph Goldstein's book just came out, Mindfulness, really bringing it back, reeling it back. What is sati? What is sati as a critical factor associated with that transition that occurs, that transformational, as one person was saying yesterday, transition that occurs through our efforts in the practice. You know, sati as receptive, sati as participatory, sati, what is this mindfulness business? Well, it has become mindfulness business. I can put mindfulness in front of anything I do and suddenly I'm part of this new consumer culture. And, you know, and it's a way to make money and lots of other wonderful things, but in terms of what this practice is and its very, very roots, there are just a few in amongst the many who are keeping it sort of in its dignity in terms of its actual sort of, how do I want to put it? Well, I'll say that that this is a practice-oriented doctrine and that everything relates, therefore, to the discovery that occurs as a result of sati or mindfulness. And then from here, the kind of transformation that occurs in our perception. And it's a different perceptual process that does include every aspect of our lives and include every aspect of the world. It's just helpful to have this Sangha here where authenticity is occurring, where people who come have a very clear and clarifying presentation of what Dhamma is. And therefore, it's been very fulfilling for me to do the Kalama Sutta and to include the full range of it past that which we might hear. It's, you know, look to ourselves to see what is true. What does that mean? Unless we go into the other four aspects of this sutta in accordance with the distinction that sati reveals, which is the distinction between that which is wholesome and that which is not. And where I want to bring Donna, this strange word we hear, into that is that there are, depending upon the lists and the tradition, 10 or 11 factors that have to do with the stabilization of consciousness that allow for the cultivation and purification of mind and body throughout time. They're called the paramis, or paramitas in Mahayana. And that means that according to the overview of how the Buddha referred to these paramis, it was because of the paramis, and dana is the first parami, that the process was attended to throughout infinite time, it's said by the Buddha, of 4 immeasurables and 100,000 eons. That these paramis were cultivated in a manner that gave rise to a quality of being. Gautama, who became Shakyamuni Buddha. And the first parami is that of dana, translated as the capacity to recognize the infinite good fortune. It's very strongly connected with the quality of joy, mudita, where suddenly there's just a release from worry, greed, other different factors that just allow for that sense of interconnectedness and energy and money and chickens, by the way, which would be dana maybe in a village in Thailand. I've seen this in Thailand. You know, it might be a chicken. It's just that sense of I value this so much. I want to continue to feed the being that is dedicated his or her life to this, so that it can continue to be what's referred to as desana, or nutrient. So we who have dedicated our lives to the practice, to this, the experiential and the intellectual, literally a few of us still do live from donations from dana. And I've made a commitment in this life to hold this principle awake and alive in this culture, because it's dying. And if dana dies, Buddhism dies. It's the first parami. In Asia, people are actually taught, lay people, only dana. Only dana. And then from here, you know, perhaps within their view, there will be the good fortune of a lifetime. A lifetime where this conducive to practice, and we are those who have this good fortune. And it's because of the merits, and the merits have to do with the awakened and purified aspects of consciousness that we remember and continue to cultivate throughout 4 immeasurables and 100,000 eons. Or it's said to the nth degree, out of deep respect, metta, gratitude for us within ourselves and all beings. So that's just a little bit about this word and how it relates to keeping this culture alive, this sangha alive, literally. Because have you noticed, nothing is asked of you. It's all just an offering. And there are a few of us left. Ajahn Amaro and I were talking about, Dejay, maybe you and I are one of the few people that still uphold this. And I don't know if that's true. I don't know, because I don't ask. You know, are you upholding dana? You know? But it is that sense of never counting the money or the chickens or the peaches I received yesterday. I mean, I counted the peaches, I ate them. I ate all 4 of them. The little tomatoes, you know. Never counting the money until it's time to just into the account, so this is what one has to pay for one's meditation hut, for food, for whatever. And I'm just clarifying, I'm not trying to impress anybody. I have no car, I have no holdings, no property, no savings, but live in faith. And, you know, not because it's like I'm a special person, but because if somebody doesn't keep this alive, then it'll die. So we who do. I do have a car that's on loan to me, so I don't want you to be concerned that I'm only preambling, you know, sort of around like the Buddha did, and such and so forth like that. But it's like that. It's a beautiful thing to live within the increasing faith that builds. So this is just a little bit about this culture that we are, that is, has taken form here in Albuquerque. That's a part of a network of sanghas where one can come and take refuge and trust that that which is being offered here is authentic, is clear, and will not create confusion, except for hopefully the confusion that we'll deal with today that has to do with our own inquiries, our own questions associated with our own experience, a direct experience. I hope this has been helpful. And I think it's helpful to have a little bit more information, you know. And I like to do this occasionally just to keep us in perspective. And I thank you. Thank you for your very open attention here. There is no possible way that we can measure the results of what Mary supports, what the Master of Ceremony supports, Fred. It's just, it's immeasurable in terms of what this Sangha and the opportunity to come here and participate represents. I think we can sense this. So I ask you to remember to offer Dana in a way that's not incidental, but substantial, out of that appreciation to the Sangha here. All of this relates to the Kalama Sutta. It's like every sutta or every primary core teaching having to do with Buddha Dhamma is a part of a nervous system, a nadi, as is said in Sanskrit, a nadi in the nervous system of this body of practice and teaching. And so every single aspect of the Buddha's teachings then transmits all other aspects. And one begins to experience this. I remember when I first sat with Upandita, back when he first came to IMS, who was he sort of the father of Vipassana in this culture. And suddenly as I was listening to him, all of the threads of everything I had ever heard and experienced sort of just came whoosh, together like that. And I went, oh, this is one teaching represented in this one recognition of the process that's going on within one's practice. It's all one. Joseph Goldstein wrote a book, One Dhamma. You know, it's, and we are the one, I am the one, who can assume this guardianship and responsibility. And so I particularly love this the sutta, where I call it the congenial sutta, because it's these villagers who are saying, you know, to the Buddha, who is just one of these venerables coming through. It's not like suddenly, you know, he's all dressed up in the Mahayana costumes of gold and, you know, kind of, he doesn't have horns and things like that that are, you know, announcing, here comes the Buddha. He's just walking around. He's just walking around like we're walking around and having conversation with people. Do you understand this? Just a human being. And he has people that walk around with him because he's a very cool guy. He's very cooled out. And he's making sense of life. And they oftentimes come to these groves, because back in those days, you know, there was a lot of nature and groves. And he was oftentimes invited, oh, you know, you're welcome to use the mango grove, you know, that I own over here. You're welcome to take residence here. And this is where the Buddha and those who were interested in being with him and kind of walking around with him lived for periods of time And so you'll see in the suttas where it says, while in the such and such mango grove or in the deer park or, like that. And, these weren't scheduled that on May 24th, whatever, however you measure it, time, 2,600 years ago, the Buddha will be, da-da-da-da, here and there. Because there wasn't a Buddha in the way that we honor these days, but just a process, just a person who was engaging others in a way that brought about clarity that just kind of knocked them for a loop and went, wow, thank you. Oh, and there was, it's that sense we all have when we hear that which is clarifying and purifying. It's just, whoosh, it's like, oh, we can feel that shift of the centrifugal force within our mind-body. Just something, just a moment of alignment. And that just brings our attention, stuns us for a moment, opens us, brings our attention into receptivity. Because he spoke from that which was the outcome of this process that we're engaging this weekend. And that you've engaged, that brought you here, or you will engage the future in the name of the practice. So simple. And it is so simple. And I am sorry when I make it sound complicated, and I am also sorry when you're listening in ways that are presented in a way that are complicated, because they're so simple. So because of this sutta that I presented on Thursday that I'm just going to kind of go over a little bit here, there was the recognition, because of the network of how information passed at that time, that there was another venerable coming that they had heard was particularly wise. But then all the venerables that came were touting wisdom. And so they just thought, well, we'll try this one out. Maybe this one can bring clarity to our concern. And the concern was, we're confused. Oh, good. One of the most helpful things I've ever heard is that, just in as a kind of soundbite, is confusion is energy looking for direction. Confusion, what am I, direction, am I going to go with this confusion? Is it the direction of thinking? What direction am I going to go with this confusion? And so in this kind of confusion, the question was, how do we know what's authentic? How do we know what's true? How do we know in a manner that we can engage? And because we have this confusion and doubt, and doubt is the state that is a kind of residual for all of our wonderings about, what to engage that allow for homeostasis. What we hear and believe to be true about existence, life, and being. And I mean this from a very primitive level, not always related so consciously to our practice. But doubt is referred to as a hindrance in our practice. But really what's meant by that, which is so beautiful, is that when we become familiar with doubt, it opens up into investigation. Whereas if we're not aware of doubt, or if we perseverate in doubt, or if we give authority to doubt, then we're in that separation where we can't experience, know directly what's occurring here. And so a respectful relationship with doubt is a very, very wonderful experience. So because of the attitude, perception of this being, Buddha, he says, I understand. He understands how it is that they are confused, because these are the causes of confusion and doubt. So he suggests, shall we reevaluate this? Oh, yes, 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 let's do it. That's what we're doing here. And so in the kind of very formal language there, which is generally repetitive, where everything's repeated over and over and over again. You know, just bringing it into something simple, the Buddha asks, you know, is everyone and anyone here over relying upon reading scriptures? And there's a term, actually, it's not a book, but that which is bound. I don't mean binding as in our suffering process, bound together, information is bound together. Because we have this kind of like, wow, you know, somebody's information is bound together, right? Whew, all right, I can read it. Oh, yeah, now I know the truth. You know, this is what this person said, or that person said, or this person. And then we go, but wait a minute, they're saying different things. Oh, I'm so confused. You know, like that. In an interview recently in Santa Fe, this man who just retired from being a professor brought his briefcase with 5 books in it. And he was just beginning, and it was beautiful. He had taken these 5 books, he had cross-referenced them, he had put it into a system, and then he was going to ask questions to see what was true. So you could imagine how much fun I had with this. We're having so much fun. He's coming every week. You know. And because he asks me these questions, and I say, yeah. Anyway, and then we inquire into the nature of the inquiry. You know, what is it that he's looking for and asking the question? It's a very sweet process. He's also English, so it makes him all the more fun. An English professor. He's lovely. He's on his way. And that sense of, okay, is it in books? And it said that in the beginning of the development of the stages of faith, F-A-I-C-T-H, that at first faith is a little bit dim, and we're trying to like find, you know, in other people's experience. And so there's a lot of modern commentary, and it's really helpful to know the distinction between the Tripitaka, the canon, and, you know, what's contained within the Tripitaka, little book, Dhammapada, so forth, and distinct from the commentary. It's a big distinction that we don't always know. So there's this wonderful possibility, you know, of recognizing that anything that we hear, it might be interesting, but it doesn't really register as having any bearing until something is known through direct experience. So the Buddha asks, you know, is some of this confusion that we're experiencing due to over-reliance upon that which is bound together in scripture? You know? Oh. And then it goes on into a more subtle inquiry. And, you know, from here, are we over-reliant upon speculation as opposed to recognizing don't know, so to speak? And this is something really interesting, to become aware of speculation. I don't know, so I'm going to speculate. It's one of my favorite games, probably all of us, you know, to speculate. Don't know is the truth, but we speculate. Are we over-reliant upon comparison? You know, the comparison between my view, your view, that person's view, whose view, what view, you know, are we over-reliant upon this? Are we over-reliant upon specious reasoning, deductive reasoning, that leads us astray? You know, it leads us back to our own limited storehouse of associations, you know? Are we over-reliant upon what we've decided? You know, this is what's true for me. Oh, boy. Have you ever had a conversation with anybody? It's like, I've been sitting for a week, and this is the way. I'm the one that understands it, and you don't? It's really interesting. And I'm not saying that disrespectfully, because there is that urge and need within to consolidate and say, I now understand. I remember one time in a retreat, somebody said, I've just done a retreat, and I really like this stuff. And so he asked Joseph, so I want to be a teacher. How do I apply? You know, like it's a school. You know, you apply to... And he says, there isn't such a thing, he said. It's all about long-term practice and the recognition through the mirroring process with the teacher of the three characteristics. And just then, perhaps, a little bit more, you know, just training to see this and that, whatever, you know. That's way back before teacher training. And then they're bringing in this and this and that. A mentorship. This is the old-fashioned style. And the guy said, I have no idea what you're talking about. He says, that's right. You know, just keep coming to retreats. You know, we're all here. We're one in the fact that we're just finding our way. It was a beautiful moment. Are we over-reliant upon that sense of self and what it wants? And then, as well, and one of the, this emphasized, it depends upon the translations, and if you're looking at translation, you'll find it authentically revealed in, or laid out in Thanissara Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu Bodhi, and particularly Andy Olinsky, a Pali scholar out at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies that I was talking to you about, who is my Pali teacher, or our Pali teacher when we were just a small group in training at IMS. So it was just, you know, this sense of evolving it in a way that's simple to understand, like this. And this is what we're doing here, is we are the villagers. Oh, and the point I was going to make, my favorite is emphasized in one sutta, and particularly, you know, investigating that kind of excitement of, this is my teacher, and the authority given to somebody else. And it's suggested that this is actually not wholesome to give authority to anybody. That what has authority is direct experience. And then we are just reflecting together, finding our way. And it's helpful to have a Dhamma mirror, you know, Dhamma mirrors to just reflect with. But if you ever meet a teacher and says, I'm a teacher and I know the way, you might just want to say, oh, okay. Well, I don't, and we don't, but meanwhile, listen with, you know, that sense of just that softness of what does reflect as opposed to giving authority to anyone. This tradition has no authority other than the teachings, practices, the application, and the direct experience. And what brings us today together, which is to clarify, our authority and our highest value is clarity and clarification, active aspect of clarification, which immediately implies purification, a view. We are not lost. We are clarifying the way through inquiry. So perhaps with this little bit of clarification, reflection, you'd like to just take a moment to realize your body's here, is breathing, it really is. Check it out. Everybody's sitting up, nobody's keeled over. Nobody's died. I've only seen one person keel over in a retreat. I thought they died, but they just fainted. And just that sense of, yeah, it is true. Verify. Is it true that this body is sitting here breathing? The body. And then this receptive mental factor, sati, is that which knows and experiences, registers, notes, sensation. It's very casual. Nothing formal about it. It just is. And the isness is so absolutely balancing, stabilizing, because it aligns the mental process with the physical process through this factor of sati, receptive awareness, direct experience, sensations. And perhaps just having remembered your practice, this might be a good time to enjoy it. This is all very simple, casual, while standing and stretching for a moment, going to the bathroom, whatever it is that your life is in this moment. Because as I said, we are living our lives, we are spending our time, literally. And in the process, we are becoming the guardians. And we can only guardian the Dhamma if we are in contact with it directly. These sensations. And it's not about learning. It's just about realizing what is occurring in every given moment, right here, right now. And just see how this applies to standing up, stretching, and whatever else, walking, for maybe 5 minutes, and then I'll ring the bell as we come back and reestablish our posture for some time in sitting practice. And then we'll open up to see what we can reflect on together.